Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. And today we are talking about full cast audio adaptations of plays. But for once, it's not something that I or the podcast are producing ourselves, but it's other people out in the rest of the world are doing this. In fact, there's been a nice little flurry of online productions, audio or visual, and it's lovely to be able to celebrate them and share them with you now. So dropping around about the same time as this podcast, it should have already dropped by the time this audio is reaching you, is a production by the Lords of Misrule of The Devil is an Ass by Ben Jonson. And it has to be said, we haven't done that much Ben Jonson on the podcast or even on our YouTube feed as of yet. So it's doubly exciting for us. So I am joined today by two intrepid explorers in the world of early modern drama, medieval drama for that matter, who I'm going to now ask to introduce themselves one at a time in an order that I should have established before I started speaking. So someone leap in and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Nick Pidd. I am directing and editing the Devil Is an Ass production from the Lords of Misrule. I am somewhat of an interloper when it comes to medieval and early modern drama, because my research interests are in Star Wars and Harry Potter, but I fell in with the Lords of Misrule when I first joined the University of York on my MA programme, and they've not been able to get rid of me yet, despite me having no earthly business being here. So that's me in a nutshell.
I'm Ross McIntyre. I'm a PhD student in medieval studies. Actually, I'm now Dr. Ross McIntyre. I've actually finished. And I got involved in Lords of Misrule back in 2012 during my master's year, and have been pretty much with a couple of absences inseparable from it since. My focus is sort of more on the medieval side. So the early modern side is a bit out of my usual comfort zone. But we like to try to stretch our range in Lords of Misrule. Mm-hmm. And I'm serving as producer for this play.
So that is who you are as individuals. Tell me, all at once or one at a time, a little about the Lords of Misrule. What are they, and why do they rule?
Well, why we rule for many different reasons, and maybe some people would disagree with us. But we are a group of mostly postgraduate students and some alumni across the University of York, mostly based at the Centre for Medieval Studies. That's where we live. King's Manor, the gorgeous building that sits in the centre of the city of York, is our home. Not that we've been able to see it for the better part of a year, but that is where we live. And we have a tradition spanning back, gosh, so is it almost 50 years at this point, Ross?
Early 1980s, yeah.
The early 1980s, the group was first founded, and it's just been handed down as a sort of beloved society from one group of committee members to the other, just nurturing this tradition of performing medieval and early modern texts and making them as accessible as possible to both academic and lay audiences. So 50 years on, audio dramas are a bit of a new frontier for us, but typically we produce three physical performances a year, and then we might also go abroad, York, if you can go to Oxford and Leeds as abroad in York, and we hopefully have a couple of additional plays here and there, but unfortunately that's also been cancelled as well, so we've been in our home since, but still Lords and still kicking.
Yeah, I mean, it is really interesting the amount of activity that's lockdown and this pandemic has created, that we still want to create productions, we still want to be active and busy, and you know, out of this adversity, that you're still doing this.
If we didn't do it, we'd probably go a bit mad. I mean, the whole reason we have Lords essentially is to distract us from our academic work or our real person jobs. Being deprived of Lords for an entire year due to COVID really wasn't an option. We had to figure out some way how to do this. And we thought about possibly doing video productions, but that seemed like an awful lot of work. And then we hit upon the idea of doing audio ones. And
that's worked
out pretty well so far.
The format has worked out beautifully, but we just, as Ross says, we just refused to go dark once COVID hit. It, as Ross rightfully says, it sort of formed the backbone of a lot of our cast members' social lives. A lot of our members are joining the centre for just 1 year for a master's programme. We do get the occasional PhD student like Ross, who stays around for a little bit longer, but we also have a couple of people who then remain in York and continue to join us from outside the university. But it really just, it's a ready-made group of friends just on your doorstep when you arrive, and especially for international students often coming from the States, there's just a ready-made group of friends with a like-minded interest in amateur dramatics and medieval studies, and you just fall into it really quickly. And it just seems such a shame just to shut our doors and just to not do anything. And so that's where the audio dramas, as Ross have said, have come from, and that's what we will continue doing until Boris says we can go back to King's Manor.
And it's actually quite cool because the audio dramas have given us the opportunity to bring back people who aren't in York. We've had an old Lords person who was in the Netherlands who was able to contribute to our Canterbury Tales production. And we've had several people from the United States, people that have left Lords after their master's programs, who've been able to just come along to these rehearsals and be part of the group again. And we can't go to the pub afterwards, but we do hang out and do online games and maybe drink a little bit as much as we can. So it's had its advantages, actually.
It has. I do miss the physical performance, just being in that room together and creating something as a team. There's nothing quite like it, and it's not a replacement, but just to have in our production, in our first audio drama, The Canterbury Tales, just to have Arcite and Palamon bickering in that cell together while one of them was in Ireland and the other one was in the Netherlands. There is a magic in that as well. We've had a whole host of Lords alumni come back to join us for these audio dramas, which has been really, really great. So that, as Ross says, there are some benefits, but ultimately it's not the same as physical performances.
Yeah, it's that wanting that buzz of the live audience reaction, getting a sense of what the play is doing to people, as well as what you're getting out of it. And
a ridiculous array of costumes.
Yes, all of our costumes
are in better shape than others, but we're quite attached to them.
Yes, yeah, we miss those very much.
It's that element of, you know, maybe once we come through the other side, he said, touching lots of wood around him, that, you know, the best of both worlds can come out of this, that the live performance can continue, but that there's some ongoing digital presence can continue. But let's talk about the present. The Devil is an Ass, your latest production, Ben Jonson, not a Ben Jonson that some people may have heard of before, even though it's got an absolutely fantastic title and a wonderful premise. So if you could just introduce the play, why it appealed to you, and just tell our audience what's so fab about it.
Oh gosh, well, everything and everyone happens in The Devil is an Ass. I think when we were first looking at our second audio drama pick and we were exploring different options, I read somewhere that The Devil is an Ass was written at the start of Ben Jonson's decline, and we said, that's the play for us. That's the energy we want. That's what we're bringing to the table. So The Devil is an Ass focuses on a group of individuals living in London. Over the course of one day, we play with that ever so slightly in the play, just for the sake of continuity and coherency. There is a nighttime scene, but it could be a middle of the day nighttime scene, you don't know. There's just so much that happens in this play. It's just truly, truly chaotic. It focuses on Lord Fitzdotterill, Fabian Fitzdotterill, who is a pompous, arrogant lord living in London and easily beguiled into the schemes of several con men. But also while he's there, he's also accompanied by one of the devil's minions, Pug, who is put on earth really just to just cause chaos and wants to prove to the devil that he can do so. And he's swept into all these machinations about social class, about gender equality, etc., etc. And then as an actor who pretends to be a Spanish woman in order to get some land and some money off of Fitzdotterill. It just goes on and on and on until it all sort of unravels at the end of the day, and it's revealed that Pug is a devil, but nobody really seems to care that much or really focus on that part anymore. it's just this absolute chaos that just bounces off of each other, and all the characters interact in such an interesting and funny way, and we really loved those character dynamics in comparison to our first audio drama in The Canterbury Tales. So much of that is action based. and a lot of, oh, here comes the knight and he's doing these fantastic things, and Arcite and Palamon are fighting, and here comes Theseus on his horse. It's such a different vibe to that. I mean, a completely different period. But just that we were really excited to have a chance to look at all these character interactions and to develop that over an audio medium, especially when you don't have characters who can take one another aside and argue in the corner before coming into the main stage again. I think that's what at the core of this play is how the characters respond and interact with one another and try and interact with their very strange lives.
And I think that it having a sort of very wordy play that is based on character interaction was a good call, because Lords, like a lot of sort of groups of that kind, is very into physical comedy. A lot of our in-person performances depend on being able to see the actors doing things, interacting with things. We even have sort of a tradition of improv on the last night, which can be improving lines, but just as often is just improving actions or expressions or sort of other things like that. And obviously we can't do that with an audio drama. I think we were a bit afraid we were losing some of that banter, some of that back and forth. And to have a play that really encourages that was, I think, a really good call.
Mm. Yeah, the Pug, who's the play opens with this wonderful sort of The Apprentice style scene with Pug just saying to Satan, "Look, please let me prove myself. Let me go down. And you're not ready." But it's got such a strong premise, and it grabs you really quickly. And just to move on to something we've broadly touched on about, you know, the process of making something happen in lockdown, but also the process of adapting a play for radio or audio, you know, the physical nature of plays, the stuff that you lose as well as the stuff that you gain, and also the fact that Ben Jonson can the plays can be quite long. Mm-hmm. and so there's a question of understatement of the year.
Yes.
We shortened it.
Yes.
Yeah. So in terms of adapting it, how much have you, in terms of cuts or changes or things that don't necessarily work as audio? I mean, it's that question of how do you navigate? How do you navigate all of those different things pulling in different directions?
It's it takes a lot of hard work. It's something I really enjoy, because even though I'm a bit of an interloper, as I've said, in medieval and early modern studies, my first degree was in creative writing. So I kind of know how to get a script and be like, right, how do I hammer out a narrative that can live on its own, regardless of the historical context. I'm not necessarily approaching it in terms of what's most authentic, but what is the most appealing. It's a fine balance to walk, because obviously I don't want to just chuck out all of the sword fighting and replace it with lasers, as much as I would like to. I think maybe some academic people and listeners might be a bit concerned. So it's a fine balance to walk, but I'm approaching it more as a kind of sort of like technical challenge than a sort of academic challenge, if you get what I mean. So yes, as you said, the play was awfully long. It was 200 odd, I think it was 200 odd pages, Ross, wasn't it, when we first we first had the transcription.
We took maybe 15% of it out,
I would say even more. We brought it right down to sort of like 100 ish pages.
One of the things that was really important that we had to do is, again, a sort of limitation of the audio medium, is that you can't distinguish, it's harder to distinguish characters from each other. Mm-hmm. When it's visually costumes and just different human beings standing on stage. So we did compress a few roles and switch some lines just to try to create these more recognizable characters so that you could associate certain kinds of dialogue with certain voices. That was something we really had to work on.
A lot of that also comes in just where we're saying that we have cast members who are joining us from the Netherlands, from the States. We really, really play with accent differences in this play. We have Fitzdottrell, played by our wonderful Stephen Hughes, who has a very traditional received pronunciation. And then there's our dear Soren, who is our Pug, who is a San Francisco brawl. And the two play off each other very, very well and are extremely distinct. And that works very, very well in terms of character dynamics. And as you say, Ross, making sure characters are recognizable from one another. When it came to that, was what we kept in mind, and keeping characters as sort of representative of themselves as possible without losing too much. As you say, there is certainly so much back and forth in Ben Jonson's work. I remember distinctly, I think it's the scene in which Whittipole is taking his allotted time to speak to Frances, and is trying to regale her and trying to woo her while Fitzdotterall is there. You know, it's a just perfectly reasonable arrangement. And before that takes place, I think Fitzdotterall and Whittipole talk for 3 pages about how witty they are, and they just go back and forth, and it's just like, I'm the wittiest. And then Fitzdotterall says, well, this is besides the point. And I'm like, that's where I cut this.
Thanks, Ben. You provided very nice guide there. If we're to cut.
Ben Jonson has said this is where we get back onto the point, so I'm going to remove anything from here that says this is not besides the point. So it's just working with even like the hints within the script and within the text as to when those characters are moving back on to the point and there isn't so much wordplay anymore. It also makes things really succinct. I think if we had just gone with the original script, we would have been recording and editing for months. We've basically been recording this since about late October, I'd say, Ross. I think that was about when things kicked off. I think if we'd stay with the script as it was, we'd probably be looking at a release in March and there'd been another 2 months worth of work to go through. But even then, I don't really know necessarily in terms of an audio drama if a 4-hour audio drama is necessarily that accessible to listen to. Like, where does one find time to sit down for a 4-hour audio drama? I mean, some of the most dedicated people out there could, but I don't know if it would hold my attention for that long.
There is an interesting question about that, because it depends on partly on how you format it and how you put it out there. If it's something that has an episodic nature to it, you can release it in episodes and people do listen to things in the background. But it is this case. I mean, the text, to put you another way, you know, is 30,000 words long, and you know, the Rubicon for us for a 2-hour play is 18,000, you know. So when you're saying 4 hours, you know, and defending the, you know, the idea of cutting a play, you know, if for a theatrical production, you really can't play this uncut. And in fact, most of Ben Jonson, there is a process of adaptation, just simply because there is too much material for anybody's arse to survive. So it really is this matter of saying this is material that you're going to be playing with, and trying to get the best out of from the kind of production that you're trying to produce. I don't think this is a play which feels very episodic in that way.
And
keeping a central narrative makes a lot of sense to me from a distance.
I mean, it's meant to take place within a day. There is only so many times, I think, obviously with audio and editing, there's plenty of fantastic resources out there for free Foley and free tracks. But I was unsure whether or not I wanted just the same street audio or the same tavern audio just to continue playing over and over if it took place within one day. So as I said, there is a night scene just to break up a little bit of that and just to provide a little bit more flavour, sort of audibly. Another thing we did to try and sort of tie everything together, because a lot of the broad text of the play doesn't even really indicate when someone's walking on and off stage. They're all there. They're all there and all chatting to each other about what's going on, or they're all having, one of them's having, one set of people are having a secret conversation while the other characters are going on about their business. And so we introduced 2 narrators who sum up before you go in as to what the scene is about. And I think that provides some really key context clues, and it really gathers the sort of like individual narratives of the scenes together as well. And the narrators also, again, they play on very distinct accents. We have our lovely Taylor Peterson, who is joining us from Florida. And then we have our lovely Daisy as well, with a Yorkshire blend of Welsh as well. And the two of them also play very well with each other audibly too. And they really summarize what's going on in the scene before you listen to it. They're like, oh, okay, I'm with you. I'm with you. I'm with you what's happening on this scene as well. And they occasionally comment on what's going on as well. I think at the I think at the end of the scene where Whittapole is revealed to be or will be taking on the role of the Spanish lady, the narrators sort of say to each other, but wasn't it meant to be that Robinson bloke? And the other one goes, no, I've got no idea what's going on either.
A fun thing to mention about that later, but
oh yes, the Spanish lady. Our Whittapole is played by our wonderful Sarah, who is Irish, and when Susanna and I, my co-director, casted this play, we knew we wanted to hear an Irish Spanish accent. We knew we wanted it, and we were going to make it happen, and it delivers.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely had to do a bit of streamlining, especially with the various schemes that get involved. Some of them are kind of more comprehensible than others. I mean, I particularly enjoyed the land drainage sort of scam that was going on, just because it seemed very topical because of the activity that was going on at the time. We definitely had to compact that a bit, so that it was really just about two scenes of sort of Meerkraft kind of floating these ideas to Fitzdottrell, instead of the like four or five there actually were.
It sort of becomes more of a cohesive one scheme in which the sort of Whittapole gets a foot in the door via offering him a cloak. Ingen also is there to kind of like lure Fitzdottrell into sort of Meerkraft's grander scheme of just generally a money and land grab. You know, we're just gonna sack this man for all of his work, and we're just gonna off we pop. So it does have a much more coherency. I mean, if in this opposed to a sort of physical staging, we could quite make it quite clear that the different schemes were afoot with the different sets of characters appearing. But as Ross says, we do need to kind of like streamline this a bit. But I really like what we've come up with. It's snappy. You know, you jump from one thing to another. You can pick up the different narratives that are happening and all the different schemes that are happening. And then when it all sort of like collapses at the very end, it's satisfying. It's satisfying to get Fitzdottrell, especially who isn't an appealing character at all, especially to kind of really get his comeuppance at the end as well.
It does also kind of do Fitzdottrell a bit of a favor in that he's not falling for like four different schemes. It's more just two different schemes.
Yes.
Because I think sometimes it does beggarly just how credulous he is.
Yeah. I didn't want to have to release a play that needed reader's notes ahead. So now this is the part where Fitzdottrell's entering into scheme 3.A.
What you do say about the narrator, though, is that is something that we've found in both the plays we've done so far, is that having a narrator to explain what's going on, especially if we've had to cut a scene that wasn't particularly crucial, but did sort of move characters from point A to point B, has been so useful, because just conveying that through dialogue is extremely difficult. Especially because even just getting characters to say their names can come off as very clunky.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in the first scene where Meerkraft's con men, Whittapole, Manly, who I voice, and Ingen are together, I think when I wrote that, I pretty much had like, what say you, Manly? Oh, I don't know, Ingen. What does Whittapole, who is about to speak next, think? That's very difficult to kind of balance, but you need that when you don't have people physically walking on stage, and it gets a little bit more clearer. But I'm really proud of what we've done. I think it really is a testament to Ben Jonson's creativity. And also we do have additional performances of his sonnets that will be interspersed through the scenes as well as thematically appropriate, which I'm really excited for as well. It does feel like a real celebration of his work, and easily one of our biggest undertakings as a group, I think, generally. We've had a couple of complicated plays before, but like in terms of the workload and the sort of like intricacies of the script development and the editing process as well, this has been one of our largest undertakings, and I think it shows. I think it's us figuring out what we're doing and how we're doing it in these weird circumstances, and I'm very proud of it.
I mean, it's a really interesting technical challenge you've touched on, because obviously, you know, I know this from our own work. You know, the problem with plays with more than about eight characters on audio is how do you get the audience to keep them in their head? So, you know, that's one of the advantages of being able to cast your net as far as around the world as you like, is that you can get radically different accents and radically different voices to make it clear just who people are. But we also have this challenge of trying to introduce people to a genuinely a text that they don't know. Whether, you know, a various text, you know, maybe with, say, the Canterbury Tales, people might know some of them. They might not know all of them, but they will probably know the more famous one, at least in ones in outline. You know, a majority of your audience won't necessarily know anything about Devil Is an Ass, and they won't know Ben Jonson. And that's one of those big challenges for any play that isn't already lodged in the popular imagination. Of how do you get people in? I mean, I sort of cheat because we do separate episodes beforehand where, you know, we basically explain everything in great and excessive detail. And then we do the full cast audio where we sort of say, well, you know, just keep up. though we do, you know, change and adjust and remove the more egregious physical stuff. But it's interesting, some physical stuff works incredibly well. Battle scenes work remarkably well on audio, mm-hmm. but punch-ups are less so. So it's interesting, sort of scale issue. So, yeah, reintroducing or helping to reintroduce a less-known Ben Jonson play. But, you know, Ben Jonson, we've already been perhaps a little rude about the amount of text that Ben Jonson produces. But I don't think anyone should ever do that because it's material we can do with, you know, there's nothing worse than a play which is missing good scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Jonson supplies us with so much wonderful material.
Which in case of medieval plays can be quite literally missing scenes, and as in pieces yes. of the manuscript are missing. And so we actually, it jumps from one point to another and we have to come up with something in the middle. So that's not a problem with Ben Jonson.
No, it's too much to work with sometimes.
we've done Mortimer His Fall, which only has the opening speech and a couple of lines. Lovely speech, really good. I highly recommend it. Ben Jonson. How would you sell Ben Jonson? How have you enjoyed Ben Jonson? Not just this play, but any other Ben Jonson that you've encountered. I mean, you came to him I'm sure lots of reasons. And any thoughts on Ben?
He's just an extraordinarily interesting individual.
Lived life he had.
Yes, he really did cover the whole bases. I mean, he went to the Netherlands to fight and apparently killed a man in single combat. He then ended up killing a fellow actor in a duel.
Busy man.
As someone who's interested in medieval religion, the fact that he basically went back and forth between Catholicism and Protestantism in the 17th century is quite something. So to see him sort of going back and forth is kind of showing that those religious lines can be a lot more permeable than we might necessarily give credit for. And he just sort of seemed like a bit of a ham, honestly. I did enjoy reading about how he and some of the other playwrights like Thomas Dekker and John Marston were basically referring to each other's works / slagging off each other's works.
So much shade is thrown between the War of the Theatres is absolutely fascinating. It's always nice to have a playwright who, you know, has committed murder. And the early modern, you know, we've got a fair few, actually. It's not a large club, but it's, yeah, a really lived life. So the works and this play, any thoughts about him as a writer and working with him?
I mean, he evidently was just like brimming with ideas. There were just lots of things that evidently caught his attention, and just the overload of things that are in Devil Is an Ass, of just the so many different references to all sorts that are just really very interesting, and the way that he expresses them as well is just so eloquent. And there were some moments just in reading the script that just genuinely had me laughing forever. And I think that it's my favorite part of the scene in which Pug meets Fitzdottrell for the first time, and he introduces himself as a devil, and Fitzdottrell says, well, you've not got cloven feet. And Pug's just like, common mistake. that's genuinely really funny. And it's just one of those things, it's just the way that characters kind of like treat each other and respond to one another is something I really like in this work. And just to work with the writings of a man who just had evidently had such an exhaustive imagination and evidently was drawing from the sort of momentum of his own life in the way just things happen just so quickly, just one after another, one thing after another, events are just stacked up on top of one another in this play. It was so much fun to get people interacting with one another in this way as our actors. And it does come back to sort of how we, the sort of spirit that Ben Jonson has in The Devil Is an Ass sort of really chimes in with the spirit that Lords of Miserable kind of have in the way of textual accessibility and sort of like in the spirit of creative collaboration that we have. We are a bit of a clique, but we work very well together. And this is a kind of like the sort of self-referential parts of Devil Is in Us, the sort of like snappy conversations between Whittlepole and Fitzdottrell, especially between Sarah and Stephen are great, because when I was editing that, I could hear Sarah grinning while shouting at Stephen about sleeping with his wife. And it's just truly fantastic. And it's really been able to bring us together in the same way that we did before, where we gathered together and we found sort of like in the spirit of collaboration and friendship. And it sort of like reawakens that for us, and just the way that the characters are so interesting with one another, what they're seeking from one another, it just really brings out so much in us, and reminds us so much of why we gathered together in the first place. I think what I'm trying to say is that the spirit of Ben Jonson and the spirit of The Devil Is in Us, it really sits very well with us as a group, and I think you can hear that in the final production.
Then the one of the things that I alluded to earlier was when I was doing some research on the play itself, finding that reference to Robinson as someone who could potentially play the Spanish lady, and learning that he was an actor with King's Men and that he was known for playing female parts, and he very well may have actually played Whittlepole. I don't know that we've had anything that direct in our Lords productions, but we've absolutely had some sly references to previous ones that people would pick up on.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially when we do our third night our third night improv.
Yes.
So I agree with Nick. I think that close camaraderie that I think probably worked really well with a company like the King's Men is something that we kind of have a bit with Lords.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't just say a bit, I would say a lot. I mean, it wouldn't just be a bit of that got us together on Zoom for the better part of a year to have me be like, okay, so could you just like, when you're grunting, when you're being beaten up, could you just like add it several times? Like, could you do it in a more posh sense? Me like also writing to other people, just be like, can I get that sound where you were just sort of crying in the corner? That would be great. Thank you.
You know, asking for these things over Christmas break, being like, oh, I didn't get that. Can you please send that to me?
Yeah, could I have a selection of screams, please?
Yes.
You start turning into Clem Fandango remarkably quickly.
I think I scared my wife a bit once when we were doing the Canterbury Tales, and I was playing the carpenter who was beating up the hapless Absalom. Or no, Nicholas.
It was Nicholas, yes. Yeah.
And so I had to record myself shouting and beating up a couch, and I think my wife was a bit taken aback by that. That was all I was recording, and just sending it off to Nick.
Oh, it was brilliant. It was totally brilliant. I mean, one of the other like benefits of the just sort of like the spirit of Lords and who we know as well, is that we've got some original music in this production as well, which is really, really cool. It's only very brief. It's our friend Erica playing the harp for us as Whittlepole confesses his love to Francis. And it's just one of those little touches, like knowing that this is someone that we know, and an old Lords family member coming back just to give us just this extra piece of music. It just really brings the productions alive. In the sense, and a real testament to who we are as a group. But to bring it all round, the camaraderie, as Ross said, sort of like that Ben Jonson evidently demonstrates in his love for the theatre scene that he was in, sort of corresponds very well with what we stand for sure.
I do find it interesting that the time period this seems to have been written, because I was seeing that Volpone is sort of 1605 to 1607, and this is 1616, I believe. So this is, he's at the court. He's, I guess he's been named poet laureate at this point. I do find it interesting that he's got this sort of, this very scathing take on people like Fitzdottrell, these sort of new money types, and then the sort of con men that are taking advantage of them. It has a feeling like he's lived in this world, gotten very, very sick of it, and then moved on to another place and is sort of ripping it off in his work. So yeah. you can sort of tell he's moved to a slightly different point in his life when he's written this.
Yeah, I agree.
Final thoughts. Where are you going next?
Well, Ross, it's your turn next, isn't it? In the director's chair?
So I'm going to be directing an audio adaptation of two of the morality plays, which are late 15th, early 16th century. That sounds a lot less interesting than it actually is, because while these do have sort of didactic morality or like sort of moral purposes, they're really quite funny. Some of them are actually quite crude. And the two we're looking at are Everyman and Mankind. They're both sort of heavily allegorical, sort of the search for salvation through sort of various means. But we've got some interesting plans, and we're going to try to integrate sort of the same narrator type thing that we're doing in The Devil's an Ass, and try to make it a bit more kind of an experience, because we've performed those plays on stage in the past. I wasn't involved in those, but Lawrence has, and we obviously want to do something a bit different. And my co-director has some very interesting ideas going forward, and so we'll see how that all works out, but I'm quite excited for it.
Shout out to Isabel. No expectations. Yep. No. Don't worry about it.
So we're hoping, to release that, I mean, probably sometime April, May, something like that.
As your editor, we'll see.
Yeah.
Not as long as The Devil Is.
No,
it is.
When Ross sent me the script and I saw that it was only 50 pages, I was like, oh, it'll be doddle. no problem.
Though, to be fair, doesn't Mankind have a gap? Is that the one?
Yeah, there is. It's one of the ones that does have a gap, which we've filled in a little bit. We're not sort of trying to add in too much.
No, we'll have some interesting stuff in there. I think some like original Latin in there as well, you know, just branch out a little bit, get some more academic integrity back again. I think just as we're looking to the future, I think my favorite part of The Devil Is an Ass, it being the second audio drama that we've all worked on, and speaking personally is like the second time that I've directed and edited an audio drama. I was also responsible for the Canterbury Tales in that regard as well. It's been nice to find our rhythm in this. And so Canterbury Tales was kind of like, what are we doing? We're going to do something. Great. What? Oh God. And just getting everybody together and finding sort of like the right happy medium for everything. Like how many takes of something do we do? How many times do we meet to record this scene? Do we want to keep rehearsing it before we do a final take? How much time do we need? And so it's been really wonderful to find our rhythm in this and to finally find our pacing and to know what it is that we're actually doing when we produce these audio dramas. I think that's probably been my favorite part. And you can, and I would certainly hope you could hear from my own ego as an audio editor, that you can hear the difference between Canterbury Tales and The Devil Is an Ass, and how much our quality overall has improved. I am extremely proud of my cast. If any of you are listening to this, I hope so. I'm all very proud of you. You wind us up. You wind us up on the committee, and when we're directing and producing and trying to wrangle you all, but we love you very much, and we're very thankful for you all coming forward and trusting us with these weird schemes and ideas as we're trying to sort of keep everything together in lockdown. You feel very patient, and I'm just very grateful for you all. Thank you. It's a sappy bit over. I'm sure there's an email from me you need to read, because I'll go do that.
I definitely think we might look a bit more into some early modern drama. We've tended to focus more on medieval, but there's only so much medieval drama there is. And Lawrence has done Volpone in the past. They've done a few other sort of things of that time period. But I think there are more, especially in terms of comedies, which our current group of Lords people, I think, is very well suited to comedy.
Yes.
Because we've got this camaraderie, because we've known each other for years in most cases. And even the people that join year to year, everyone seems to click very quickly. So I think looking into seeing more comedies in the early modern period might definitely be something we should do.
It really seems that the academic sphere on Twitter has really welcomed that there's an upcoming production of The Devil Within Us that can be listened to. Just sort of the general excitement is something we don't really usually sort of see. I mean, it's difficult in terms of sort of switch we found in the switch from like sort of physical production into audio is that we tend to have a niche audience. We drive to have textual accessibility, so anyone who happens to wander in and is interested kind of can get the drift of what's going on and isn't intimidated by kind of like the academic sort of like context obscuring it. But the vast majority of our audiences are academic, and to branch out of just sort of like branch briefly out of the medieval into the early modern and just have to such a welcome reception, it really is encouraging that that we can continue on with this and we can continue to branch out in this way. So I am, yes, I don't completely echo Ross. I am really excited to look at more early modern stuff and sort of broaden our repertoire as I might say. So
well, I know from our exploring sessions that we've got a long list of fun comedies we can recommend if you're
oh, please.
Hunting comedies. Am I not at all?
No.
It's that thing of being able to create accessible things that live on the internet that anyone can access. And that's really one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, because it chimes very much with what we do, is that, you know, if we want to extend the theatrical repertoire, to, you know, build a larger audience for people to see things live when, you know, once again, hopefully, we can do these things live again, one has to use the wider media tools that are available. And it's lovely to see another group engaging and doing not just one, but planning more. And I'm really looking forward to seeing, or more importantly, hearing what you're doing in the future. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
All that remains is to thank my guests, Nick and Ross, for sharing all their wonderful thoughts about The Devil Is an Ass by Ben Johnson. The audio for that should be available by the time this podcast is released. Links to that will be available in the show notes. Otherwise, you should be able to, you know, use a search engine. It'll probably bring it up eventually. That's what the internet's for. That's how it functions. Do you really expect us to spoon feed you everything? Oh, you do. Okay, the links will be in the show notes. Thank you very much, and goodbye.